From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
As the U.S. war against terrorism begins to spread, there's almost certainly more unrest about to appear throughout the region. So far from closing things down, U.S. power is likely, I think, to be stirring them up in ways that can't always be contained.
Palestinian-American scholar Edward Said on the cycle of violence. And as nuclear powers India and Pakistan move towards war, we'll hear from a Pakistani peace activist about the meaning of the escalation in the wake of the bombing of Afghanistan. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Two Palestinians and an Israeli soldier died yesterday when Palestinians ambushed an Israeli patrol on the Jordanian border. The ambush followed a holiday weekend in which Israel arrested six Islamic militants on the West Bank, and the ceasefire ordered by Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat appeared to be crumbling. After Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon defied the Christian world by barring Arafat from attending midnight mass in Bethlehem on Christmas Eve, Arafat delivered a, quote, heavy-hearted speech on Palestinian television, which was relayed live to a subdued crowd in Manger Square, where a large banner read, Sharon assassinates the joy of Christmas. But barely 12 hours later, the leaders announced negotiations for a ceasefire would continue. After intense pressure from the U.S. and India, authorities in Pakistan yesterday said they arrested the founder of the Jaish-e-Mohammed organization, a militant Islamic group that Indian officials blame for a recent attack on the Indian Parliament building. The detention of Masood Azhar is the most significant step taken by Pakistan's military government to clamp down on those accused of staging the attacks to end Indian rule in Kashmir. Indian and Western intelligence agencies say Azhar has close links with the Taliban as well as Pakistan's intelligence service. Thousands of Pakistani troops have been clambering up the ragged border peaks of southwest of Islamabad for more than a week to seal off isolated escape routes out of Afghanistan. In Afghanistan's Tora Bora region, U.S. commandos and Afghan guerrillas still poke through the caves and bunkers where fighters from the Al-Qaeda organization made their last stand. But after 2.5 months of bombing and a manhunt aided by the world's most advanced intelligence-gathering devices, Osama bin Laden is still not in anybody's gun sights. Hundreds of asylum seekers stormed the tunnel between France and Britain yesterday, trying to force their way into England by walking the 25 miles through the Channel Tunnel. About 550 people took advantage of the quiet Christmas period to try to take over the tunnel, but none made it through. French police arrested 129 people in the first wave of refugees. At midnight, a second wave of some 400 was pushed back by French riot police using tear gas outside the Calais entrance to the tunnel. Refugees regularly try to enter Britain illegally from France on ferries, by train, or through the Channel Tunnel. In the last year, thousands of refugees have made that trip. This news from Moscow. A Russian military journalist who exposed nuclear waste dumping by the Russian Navy was convicted yesterday of treason and sentenced to 4 years in prison on a case that critics said illustrates the risks of antagonizing the Russian military. The ruling capped 4 years of legal twists and turns for Grigory Pasko, a 39-year-old Navy captain from Vladivostok, who reported on environmental abuses by the Russian Pacific Fleet. Although the judge threw out 9 counts of treason against Pasko, he was found guilty of collecting information on secret military exercises with the intention of passing it on to Japanese journalists. Zimbabwe's main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, accused the government of intensifying intimidation, blaming it for deaths of 3 of its members over the last 4 days. The MDC's leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, said he believed the deaths marked the beginning of a new campaign of violence and intimidation against the MDC in the run-up to the presidential election in March. Meanwhile, the government has accused the opposition of mounting terrorist attacks against its supporters. The man who authorities say hid explosives in his shoes and tried to ignite them during a transatlantic flight on Saturday has been placed under a suicide watch pending a psychological examination. Authorities said they were still trying to determine a motive for his actions and have not yet ruled out possible links to Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. While his identity remains unconfirmed, his passport bears the name John C. Reed. British authorities believe the passport is valid. Meanwhile, the Times of London reported today that Reed attended the same London mosque as Zacharias Massaoui, the Frenchman charged with conspiracy in connection with the September 11th attacks. And a report yesterday in France's La Provence newspaper, citing police and intelligence sources, said Reed had belonged to an Islamic movement called Tablighi, but left because he said it was not radical enough for him. A bond hearing is scheduled for Friday. If convicted of intimidation or assault of a flight crew, Reed could be sentenced to 20 years in prison. According to a senior official at the Internal Revenue Service, illegal tax shelters saved big companies at least $14.7 billion in federal income taxes last year. Now all companies are being offered an amnesty in return for confessing their illegal tax avoidance. The 95 companies that have already confessed their tax avoidance strategies to the IRS this year short-shrifted the government an amount equal to a dollar a week for every man, woman, and child in the United States. In a break from past practice, Langdon announced on Friday that companies that disclosed dubious tax shelters and the promoters who sold them by April 23rd would not be charged the usual 20% penalty on taxes that were improperly avoided. "This is our Christmas present to big companies," he said. "We're going to determine who's naughty and who's nice by waiving the 20% penalty for those who are nice to the IRS." And in a victory for the energy industry, the Bush administration is expected to announce soon that it is weakening a key clause of the 1970 Clean Air Act. The clause, which is known as the New Source Review, requires all power plants built before 1970 to install up-to-date pollution controls as soon as they undergo renovation. If eased, coal-burning power plants will be allowed to bypass tough anti-pollution rules, and neither elected officials nor environmentalists will be able to bring them to court. President Bush has been looking to weaken the Clean Air Act for some time, claiming its rules stifle energy output and do little to protect the environment. But it's only now that his approval ratings are soaring in the wake of the so-called war on terrorism that he's moved to revisit the issue. The utility industry was one of Bush campaign's staunchest supporters in the 2000 election. Edwin Starr, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodwin. Before we turn to Edward Said talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we've just made contact with a TV journalist crew that is on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. They are the founder of DCTV, where we're based at the firehouse just blocks from the first Ground Zero, Afghanistan being the second. John Alpert, his daughter Tommy Alpert, as well as Masuda Sultan, who is an Afghan woman, who they are traveling with to trace her roots back in Afghanistan. Tommy Alpert now joins us on the phone. I understand it's not a great one, but we thought it was worth the risk. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Tommy.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Where are you right now?
Right now we're on the road. We're driving back. We were just in Chemin, which is a border town, and we're headed back to Quetta. We were there in Chemin visiting a refugee area, and Masuda's organization purchased a bunch of supplies that we were distributing through the UN to the refugees.
And what is the situation like in the refugee camp?
Sorry, hear you?
What is the situation like in the refugee camp?
Well, unfortunately, we didn't spend too long at the camp. We're returning again tomorrow. The UN has actually provided them with tents and with food. And when we asked them what else they really needed, they said the largest thing we could provide for them is peace. And that's the same thing that all of the refugees that we spoke with echoed.
We're going to be following you on your trip into Afghanistan every day, speaking to one of you on the crew, as well as Masuda Sultan. But today, can you lay out why you are there? What is your plan for this 2 weeks?
Well, we are following Masuda. We followed her from New York City. She is an Afghan who has lived in New York ever since she was 5 years old. And I'm actually going to put her on the phone with you right now so that you can speak with her. And tomorrow is our first day that we're actually going into Afghanistan. So here she is. Hold on, please.
We're talking with Masuda
Sultan. Good morning to you.
It's good to have you with us. So what has your experience been like so far? When was the last time you were in Afghanistan?
I'm sorry, it's difficult to hear. Can you repeat, please?
When were you last in Afghanistan?
The last time I was in Afghanistan was in August. I went back to visit my family. I had left at the age of 5 and hadn't seen them.
So can you tell us about your trip to the refugee camp and what your organization is, what you were giving out?
We wanted to see what the situation was like for the new influx of refugees as a result of the U.S. bombing. And we went to a camp just here in Chemin, as you heard before. It was run by UNHCR, and we found out that they were providing them with tents and food, etc. We wanted to assess the situation, see what was needed. My organization brought them some rice and some sugar. And we found out that that these people are doing okay, although by the looks of it, it seems like they're just barely surviving.
You're going to be traveling to Kandahar, where you come from. What are your thoughts right now? Do you feel anxiety after the very serious bombing of your city?
I absolutely feel anxiety. I'm worried at what I may find there. Just after I get off the phone with you and we drive back in Quetta, I'm going to visit some family that was directly affected by the bombing. They lost about 19 members as part of my mother's cousin's family. And I'm very worried about what I'm going to find there and the looks on their faces. And I don't know what I'm going to find at Kandahar. A lot of my family has left, and I'd be curious to see what has happened to our old house, which was completely intact in August.
What was it like for you to meet the Afghan refugees, people from your own country? You can speak to them directly. And you are also a U.S. citizen, and it's because of the bombs of the United States that they've been driven out.
Yes, in many ways, I could understand. I felt like I was in the same boat with these Afghans, because we really have little control over what these large powers do, although as an American, I think I have more of a capability to affect change in terms of lobbying the government, etc., than they do. These people are really helpless, and they're just victims of what's going on. it hurt me a lot to see that the people that came from the very same town that I was born in and that my parents grew up in, were suffering like this. I felt some sort of responsibility for this. Yeah, I could not convey that to them.
I understand that Pakistan is not giving Afghans political refugee status, often forcing them to go back into Afghanistan, although they say they're doing so voluntarily.
I'm sorry, I heard the part about Pakistan not granting refugee status to some of these people. And I will address that by saying that Pakistan, it's very obvious that Pakistan doesn't have the capability to deal with these people. And a lot of them are being forced behind the border to stay in Afghanistan. We have not visited the camps or the people on the other side of the border just over in Afghanistan, but we hear the situation is very grave there. UNHCR does not currently have a presence in Afghanistan, and the people living just on the other side of the border are not getting the aid that they need.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Masuda Sultan, and we will continue with your Afghan journey tomorrow as you make your way into Afghanistan.
Thank you, and we'll report into you what we find on the other side of the border and in Kandahar.
Good luck and be
safe.
We'll speak to you in 24 hours. Thank you. That report from Masuda Sultan and Tommy Alpert on the border, the Pakistan side of the Afghan Pakistan border, as they make their way into Afghanistan, the crew with DCTV, where we are based, Downtown Community Television, led by John Alpert, the founder of Downtown Community Television. And we will continue with the Afghan journey each day that they are there. So do stay tuned as they make their way from the first ground zero here in New York to the second in Afghanistan. And now we turn to Zia Mien, who is a Pakistani-American scientist and anti-nuclear activist. You heard the latest news in the headlines, if you were tuned in them, about the latest tensions between India and Pakistan. And as India and Pakistan continue moving troops along their border in the largest military buildup in more than a decade, the leaders of the two nuclear rivals said yesterday they did not want a confrontation and blamed each other for the rising antagonism. The sentiment has been aired by presidents of both countries. The background on the situation in Pakistan, India, for more than 50 years, the two countries have been at bitter odds over several disputed territories along their common border. By far the most intractable, however, has been the dispute over Kashmir. The countries have fought two wars over the region, first in 47, 48, then in 65, and ongoing skirmishes along the ceasefire line have left thousands dead each year. In the summer of 99, the two nuclear powers came to the brink of another war after Pakistani-backed forces infiltrated Indian-controlled Kashmir. A bitter two-month conflict ensued, ending only when Pakistani forces withdrew. Since then, the region has been relatively quiet. But this past October, the worst fighting in more than a year broke out as India started shelling what it called Pakistani military positions. The situation has only devolved from there, with alleged Pakistani militants attacking the Indian parliament just 2 weeks ago. Now, in the latest development, India has recalled its ambassador to Pakistan, hinting strongly that war is imminent. We turn now to a speech given recently by Pakistani peace activist Zia Mien, who examines the escalation of the India-Pakistan tensions within the context of the U.S. so-called war on terrorism. The speech was delivered at a conference sponsored by the American Friends Service Committee. Zia Mien is a Pakistani peace activist and lecturer at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University.
Now is very briefly talk about some of the events that have started to unfold. My point of departure will be an old saying that some will remember, that war is the midwife of history. And this war and this administration and governments around the world have proceeded to accelerate and help the delivery of a child that has been long in the gestation. What we're seeing, in my opinion at least, is we have rewound the clock back to the beginnings of the Cold War, before the Soviet Union became a power able to counter that of the United States. So we're back to the late 1940s and the early 1950s. And there were all kinds of things that happened then. And I think it pays all of us to follow Noam's advice and go read some history books from that period as to just what was going on when you saw the effectively unchecked exercise of US power in terms of destabilizing governments, undermining social progressive movements, and starting to shape the world into not its own image, but into an image that suited certain interests in the United States. Now, what I want to say is that what we saw in the early 1950s and what we're seeing again now very clearly is that as an empire establishes itself, it offers people and governments very few choices. And many governments in the 1950s and many governments now are seeing that there are advantages to inciting empire, to take advantage of an empire to serve their own narrow domestic political and economic interests. And nowhere has that been more clear than in South Asia, where after September the 11th, the government of India rushed to the United States and said, you can use Indian military bases, you can use Indian ports, you can use Indian airstrips. We will help you all the way in this war against terrorism. Why, after 50 years of non-alignment and Indian notions of independence in the world and presenting itself as a counter to the notion of unchecked power, the government of India should rush to this kind of new position, I think bears scrutiny. And what it was that if the US had gone with India, as India tried to get them to do, it would have marginalized Pakistan. It would have consolidated India's role in the region. It would have given India the example and the opportunity to pursue its own narrow national interests, because the US would have become the godfather to India. Pakistan, seeing this, rushed to the US and said, oh, but look, we trained the Taliban. We know where Osama is. You should use us. And why Pakistan should have dumped the Taliban, who they worked so assiduously to create, right, was precisely the fact that they saw an even greater threat looming on the horizon. They could afford to lose Afghanistan if they could get back into the good books of the United States. So we're seeing a competition for who can be closest to the United States among ruling governments and elites around all these countries. The dilemma that we face, not just in South Asia, but around the world, is that as governments rush to cultivate the United States, as they rush to create their own lobbies, as they rush to present themselves in a whole series of ways as loyal allies in the war against terrorism, as they rush to present themselves as potentially open markets, as sources of cheap labor, as guarantors of all kinds of stability, is what happens to people in all this?
Zia Amin, a lecturer at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, Pakistani-American scientist. We'll have more on that speech in the second hour of the War and Peace Report. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile. Back in a minute with Professor Edward Said.
Yeah. but thou art mighty, holy in thou
hand. Sweet Honey in the Rock. Here on the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. Just as the Afghanistan new provisional government was preparing to take power last week, offering a possible end to decades of violence, President Bush announced that 2002 would still be a war year for the United States. Echoing a statement he made at the beginning of the campaign against al-Qaeda, the president warned that the so-called war on terrorism had only just begun and was likely to spread to other corners of the globe. While Bush has not yet confirmed any targets, he's hinted, along with his advisors, that Somalia, Yemen, or Iraq could be next. We turn now to Professor Edward Said, talking about the conflict in the Middle East. He's a professor of comparative literature at Columbia University, was born in Jerusalem in 1935 before partition, and has been an eloquent voice for justice throughout the Palestinian struggle. Professor Edward Said.
In any case, I'd like to speak about the general situation in which we find ourselves after September the 11th, and then I want to focus specifically on the Middle East. As somebody from West Asia, I'm pleased to be addressing a forum organized by South Asians, and since I don't believe in artificial divisions of that sort, nevertheless, perhaps geographical identifications are not useless all the times. But as a child of war myself, having been born into a war contest, being an adolescent in one, and then maturing in others, I've always felt that wars are never a solution. They seem to often beget other wars, as was the case with World War II, which produced colonial wars elsewhere, and certainly in my part of the world, we've had our share of those, plus, of course, civil wars, insurgencies, and so on. So I think the general situation of belligerency, can you hear me well or not? No, sorry about that. Yeah. Yes, louder. Is this better?
Yeah.
Right. I was simply saying that wars have always, you know, seemed to me to produce other wars, and they really are deeply unsatisfactory solutions to problems that and issues that arise and seem inevitably to lead to war, such as September the 11th. I don't think this is an exception, the war that we're in now and other wars that we may be heading towards. A few days ago, I received a letter from an admired friend of mine, a retired professor of history, who is certainly one of the greatest scholars produced in this country. In his letter, he wrote me the following: "In the current madness of our nation and the world, it seems determined to conquer. It seems to me that never in the many political crises that I've experienced, beginning with the Wallace campaign, have I felt so pessimistic about the country and so impotent. There seems to be no stirring of a movement, no social and cultural base from which an opposition could grow. The way in which Sharon is imitating Bush to eliminate the Palestinian government and consolidate Israeli domination, with nothing but anti-colonial men of desperation left to express the aspirations of the Palestinians, it is too horrendous. I wait for the U.S. to invade Iraq next." Now, these are certainly sentiments that I share in many ways, and that many of us who are Americans from the Islamic and Arab world also share. There's no point here in stressing what everybody in the world has already stressed endless times, that the dreadful September 11th terrorist attacks have had a profound effect not only on the city where we all live, and which so many of us have found to be a refuge from an old world of war and misery, as well as a superb place to work and study and teach and bring up children, But also, it's had terrible effects on the world, not at all in finally salutary ways. There's no need at all now for me to try to compete patriotically with all the uncounted zillions of words that have been uttered or written expressing shock, outrage, anger, sorrow at the events of September the 11th. But there is a need, I think, to go beyond and think reflectively and critically, something which, alas, the present environment hasn't been so hospitable to. As a nation, we risk, I think, entering into an anti-democratic triumphalist phase, and this, which is huge power unopposed or unchallenged on grounds of fear or of angering the majority or of seeming unpatriotic, this would be a national and moral catastrophe of great proportions. We need always to be asking ourselves what events mean, what they represent, and who and what any particular speaker represents, who and what constituency, and for what purpose and interest they speak for. That is the type of debate which is the real health of democracy to which we must all remain committed. Now, as a deeply secular intellectual who has always suspected and made clear my disagreement and discomfort with religious politics, I find that the current war, not just against terrorism, which must always be critically analyzed and distinguished into types and kinds, but against what has been characterized vaguely as a kind of metaphysical evil, has been an extremely problematic one. First of all, because as Americans we have taken on the role of righteous avengers, which with the enormous military and political and economic power wielded by the U.S. has made for scenes of awful destruction and unforeseen circumstances all over the world, as well, of course, as creating vast new abstractions both to be for and to be against. Islam and the West, or America, I've said repeatedly, are generalizations I find difficult to follow blindly. I'm not one of the people, though, who ever had any time for Islamists or fundamentalists or the religious right anywhere that they have fought. They have brought nothing but deception, disappointment, tragedy, and waste wherever they've preached their gospel of indiscriminate war, in the case of the Islamists against the Kuffar. And I have no regret in seeing the demise of the Taliban regime and the Al-Qaeda. But I think it's incumbent on us to have equally critical assessments of all so-called faith-based politics, whether in the Muslim world or elsewhere. Bombing abortion clinics and preventing the teaching of evolution on religious grounds are as reprehensible here as imprisoning or abusing women at home there, and for that matter, discriminating against non-majority religions in places, whether like Saudi Arabia or Israel, where I think such practices have to be opposed. The trouble with the present time, though, is that majority opinion seems to be represented not only by the government, which in its search for unity must appear to speak with one voice, I suppose, but also all or most of the other voices, those of the media in particular. I have found that this idea of unity, the political image that the government and the media, which has acted mostly without independence from the government, is what is being projected now. There really is a feeling being manufactured by the media and the government that a collective we exists and that we all act and feel together, as witnessed perhaps by such unimportant surface phenomena as flag flying and the use of the collective we by journalists in describing events all over the world in which the U.S. is involved. We bombed, we said, we decided, we acted, we feel, we believe, etc., etc. Of course, this is only marginally to do with the reality, which is far more complicated and far less reassuring. There's plenty of unrecorded or unregistered uncertainty and skepticism, I think, lots of questioning, even outspoken dissent here and there, but it seems hidden by overt patriotism. So American unity is being projected with such force as to allow very little questioning of U.S. policy, which in many ways is heading towards a series of more complex events after Afghanistan, the meaning of which many people will not realize until far too late. In the meantime, American unity needs to state to the world that what America does and has done cannot brook serious disagreement or discussion. Just like bin Laden, Bush tells the world, you are either with us or you are with terrorism and hence against us. So on the one hand, America is not at war with Islam, but only with terrorism. And on the other hand, in complete contradiction with that, since only America decides who or what Islam and terrorism are, we are against Muslim terrorism and Islamic rage as we define them. I've been astonished at how much cant and zeal and phony expertise there has been on the media, with a few exceptions. I mean, I've never seen a situation quite like this one. Leaving aside all the military expert, or as The Economist has called them, all the justly retired military analysts, the experts on Islam, people like the ever so arrogant and vulgar Thomas Friedman with his dreadful letters. I'm going to come back to him in a minute. As well as the ponderously vindictive and shallow Fuad Ajami and Daniel Pipes and the extraordinarily falsehood-mongering Bernard Lewis. I wish I had time to go over some of the stuff he says in that article he did a couple of months ago in The New Yorker, which I don't read anymore. All of them have been unanimous in their shallow generalizations, their gratuitous, uncritical repetition of cliches, their unhelpful and uninformed denunciations of a world that they have willfully turned into essentially a satellite of Osama bin Laden's crazed mind. There are, we need to remind ourselves, there are 1.3 billion Muslims in the world. There are many, many languages, many traditions, many peoples, many histories, all of them claiming to be Muslim. But none of them is collapsible into things like rage or militancy or extremism. Then there's the, to go back to Friedman for a second, and I don't really want to waste too much time on him. But, I mean, he keeps repeating this ridiculous thing about how Islam needs a reformation. Well, how many reformations were there? There was one. Spain never had a reformation. Why doesn't Spain get preached at for having produced the ETA terrorists?
You're listening to Professor Edward Said, Professor of Comparative Literature at Columbia University, and we'll be back with his speech in just a minute here on the War and Peace Report, and you can go to our website as well to find out more information at democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. Mao Zedong said, A3, here on the War and Peace Report, as we return to a speech by Professor Edward Said, Professor of Comparative Literature at Columbia University, author of numerous books, articles, and essays, a voice for justice throughout the Palestinian struggle. Professor Said.
Turn now from the general situation to one specific situation, namely the Middle East, which during the course of the war against terrorism since September the 11th, both the U.S. government in the persons of the President and Colin Powell, Secretary of State, and the British government in the person of persons of Blair and Jack Straw, the foreign minister, have made specific reference to the need for a Palestinian state. In the meantime, as something important, you know, to keep the coalition together. In the meantime, the situation on the ground, partly as a result of September the 11th, but, you know, going back in time way before it, has gotten worse. And what I'd like now to spend the rest of the time doing is talking about the situation in Palestine as a quite different situation from that of Afghanistan. I wanted to remind you that there is a wonderful poem written in 1982, which by the leading Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. It's a poem that begins, "The world," and he wrote it, I should mention, in September of 1982. "The world is closing in on us, pushing us through the last passage, and we tear off our limbs to pass through." Then he says, "Where shall we go after the last frontiers? Where should the birds fly after the last sky?" I use that line, "after the last sky," as the title of a book I wrote in 1986 with a photographer, Jean Moore. It's now 19 years later, it's 2001. The Palestinian situation is much the same as it was in 1982, although it's worse because it's happening in Palestine, not Lebanon. Once again, Ariel Sharon and his military have surrounded an overwhelmingly civilian population of Palestinians. This time, they're besieged and imprisoned inside the West Bank and Gaza, which was occupied by Israel since 1967, of which 28% of the West Bank and 60% of Gaza have been allowed Palestinians since the Oslo process. The rest of the land has been taken over by 400,000 Israeli settlers in 145 settlements, including those on Palestinian land around Jerusalem. Since the Intifada began last September, Palestinians have been shut up by the Israeli military in villages, towns, cities, and farms into no less than 220 discontinuous little ghettos, blockaded, imprisoned for 15 straight months, in addition to curfews inside the towns from time to time, often for weeks at a stretch. No one, young or old, sick or well, dying or pregnant, student or doctor, can move without going through hours at the barricades manned by rude and purposely humiliating Israeli military searches. At this moment, 200 Palestinians are unable to receive kidney dialysis just because the Israeli military won't allow them to go to medical centers because of security reasons. There must be thousands and thousands of young Israeli conscripts who are abusing an entire population like this for months on end, with only a few refusing this demeaning and sadistic service. And one question that comes to mind, have any of the legions of foreign media personnel who cover the conflict, which is about as one-sided as any in history, have any of them done a story about these brutalized young Israelis trained chiefly to punish Palestinian civilians collectively as the main part of their military duty in the name of the Jewish people on the land of Israel? Compare this, please, with the enormously well-covered sins of the fundamentalist Taliban. As the Islamic Conference foreign ministers emergency meeting opened on December the 10th in Qatar, Yasser Arafat was not allowed by Israel to leave his office in Ramallah. His speech was read by an aide. 15 miles away from Ramallah in Gaza, the airport and the two aging Palestinian helicopters were destroyed a week earlier by Israeli planes and bulldozers, with, this is very important, with no one and no force to check, much less prevent, the daily tank incursions by Israel, of which this particular feat of military daring was a part. Gaza Airport is the only airport, is the only rather port of entry directly into Palestinian territory, and the only civilian airport in the world destroyed wantonly since World War II. Periodically, Israeli F-16s, generously supplied by the United States, have bombed and strafed, Guernica-style, Palestinian towns and villages. These, by the way, jets were never used by South African apartheid to bomb the townships in South Africa under apartheid. They're used regularly by Israel against Palestinians in their towns and villages, during which, of course, vast amounts of property are destroyed and lost, many civilians and police officials killed. There is no Palestinian army or navy or air force, and certainly no air or any other kind of defense to protect the people, and all of this is done at will. Apache attack helicopters, again supplied by the U.S., have missile murdered 77 Palestinian leaders, allegedly for terrorist offenses, past or future, with a group of unknown Israeli intelligence operatives holding decision-making powers for these assassinations, presumably also approved by the cabinet and, of course, by the U.S., which has tacitly approved of the practice of self-defense. The helicopters have also done an efficient job of bombing Palestinian Authority installations, police as well as civilian. During the night of December 5th, the Israeli army entered the five-story offices of the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics in Ramallah, carried off the computers, every file and every report, then destroyed the building in an act of theft and vandalism designed to efface as many of the significant traces of collective Palestinian life as possible. In 1982, the same army, under the same commander, entered West Beirut, carted off documents and files from the Palestinian Research Center, then flattened the structure. A few days later came the massacres of Sabra and Shatila. The suicide bombers of Hamas and Islamic Jihad have, of course, been at work, as Sharon knew perfectly well that they would, since after a 10-day lull in the fighting in late November, Sharon suddenly ordered the murder of a Hamas leader, a man called Mustafa Abu Hannoud, an act designed quite consciously to provoke Hamas into retaliation and then enable his armies to resume their butchery of Palestinians. 8 barren years of discussions, of peace discussions, that brought Palestinians 50% unemployment, 70% rate of poverty, which means that people are living, 70% of the population is living on less than $2 a day per person, and a 60% increase in the number of settlements, and of course the endless suffering of basically unopposable house demolitions and the unspeakably cruel Israeli practice of destroying trees and orchards have left residents of the occupied territories with no real options. Yet Sharon has the gall to keep repeating, and this is why I want to speak about it this evening, he keeps repeating that Israel has suffered the same terrorism as that meted out by bin Laden in the United States, even as 5 or 6 Palestinians to 1 Israelis have been killed in the last few months alone, with over 30,000 direct Palestinian casualties. Under the liberal regime of Ehud Barak, there was a 60%, as I said a moment ago, a 60% increase in settlements, along with a dramatic expansion of the road system for Jewish drivers only. I mean, if you're non-Jewish, you cannot drive on these settlement roads. The Oslo process made movement nearly impossible for most Palestinians, and as for entry from the West Bank into Arab East Jerusalem, which was annexed by Israel, that too has been forbidden for the last several years. Palestinian universities, hospitals, clinics, and schools have regularly been closed with scarcely a note of it made by the Western media, which has been busy chronicling violence through lenses provided by the Israeli military. The crucial point in all this, and I really cannot insist on it more strongly, is that Israel has been in military occupation of Palestinian land since 1967. This is the longest such occupation in history. and the only occupation anywhere in the world today. This is the original and continuing violence against which all the Palestinian acts of violence have been directed. Yet there has never been any narrative of this occupation or of the enormous amount of Palestinian suffering in place before either the Israeli or the world public. And in this, I think the media plays an incredible part under, obviously, pressure from the Zionist lobby. I'll give you an example. Yesterday, in the Sunday New York Times and the Week in Review, there was a long article by James Bennett about how Israel is becoming like Lebanon. And throughout the entire article, which goes started on page one and continues for several columns on an inside five, you know, page five, there isn't a single mention of the fact that that the violence on the West Bank is in occupied territory. So if you don't happen to know it, you just get the impression that Palestinians are just doing violence because they just hate Jews and they want to kill Israelis and so on and so forth. So the actual condition of military occupation is simply effaced from the narrative. And you don't get an impression at all that there is anything particularly wrong. It's just that, you know, Palestinians like to kill Israelis. On December the 10th, for instance, two children aged 3 and 13 were killed by Israeli bombs in Hebron. Yet at the same time, an EU delegation, along with the US, was demanding that Palestinians should curtail violence and terrorism. On December the 11th, five more Palestinians were killed, all of them civilians, the victims of helicopter bombings of Gaza's teeming refugee camps. To make matters worse, as a result of the September 11th bombing, the word terrorism is being used to blot out acts of resistance against military occupation, something Israel has been doing in its propaganda since the 1970s, to call everything that Palestinians do as resistance against military occupation, or call it all terrorism, and to make it impossible for there to be any causal or even narrative connection between the dreadful killing of civilians, which I've always opposed, and the terrible suffering of 35 years of collective punishment that gives rise, direct rise, to suicide bombings. What every Western pundit or official who pontificates, as they all do, about Palestinian terrorism needs to ask is how simply forgetting or overlooking the very existence of the military occupation is supposed to stop terrorism. Of course it can't. Doubtless because of frustration and poor advice, Arafat's great mistake was in trying to make a deal with the occupation, which was what I think the Oslo peace process was all about. And it was always about Israeli security. Not a word was ever said, because the Israelis are so powerful and the U.S. support them, that not a word was ever said about Palestinian security and the need for a Palestinian state. And indeed, that bizarre obsession with Israeli security to the exclusion of nearly everything else has become the valid international idiom through which General Zinni, the former Marine commander who has been in Palestine and Israel for the last couple of weeks and then has been recalled, and Javier Solana preach at the PLO while remaining totally silent about the occupation. It's absolutely grotesque. Since 1992, the Israeli mistake has been to imagine that by conning Arafat and his coterie into interminable discussions and tiny concessions, that they were going to get general Palestinian acceptance, which, like most of Israel's gambles over time, have proved to be failures. All official Israeli policies thus far have proved to be worse rather than better for Israel than before. Anyone can prove what I'm saying by simply asking the question, is Israel more secure and more accepted now than it was 10 years ago? And the answer has to be no. The terrible, and in my opinion, stupid Hamas suicide raids against civilians in Haifa and Jerusalem over the weekend of December 1 and 2 should be condemned, yes. But in order for these condemnations to make any sense, they must, in my opinion, be bracketed with the Israeli assassination of Abu Hanoud earlier in the week, along with the killing also early in the week of five Palestinian children by what has been admitted to be a deliberately planted Israeli booby trap in Gaza. to say nothing of the 20 houses destroyed, the miscellaneously killed Palestinians throughout Gaza and the West Bank villages, the constant tank incursions, and the endlessly detailed grinding down of Palestinian life, and the consequently blocked realization of Palestinian independence, minute by minute, for the past 35 years. In the end, desperation only produces poor results, none worse than that George W. and Colin Powell seem to have given Sharon a green light while he was in Washington on December the 2nd, just as Al Haig gave him a green light in May of 1982. The instructions seem to have been, you can do anything you like, because Bush is so obsessed with terrorism and he considers Palestinian terrorists. So he told Sharon, do anything you like, but don't kill Arafat. And with this support went the usual ringing declarations about ending the violence and fighting terrorism, so that the people under occupation for almost four decades and their hapless, inept leader were suddenly turned into worldwide aggressors required to bring to justice their very own criminals, even as the Israeli army was systematically destroying the entire Palestinian police structure, which was supposed to do the arresting. I have no doubt that Sharon and his people are by now so habituated to their own fabrications that they actually believe they are not the poor bastards whose lives they've been making miserable since 1948 are the victims. In effect, then, Arafat is hemmed in on all sides, a perhaps ironic result of his appetite for being all things Palestinian to everyone, enemies and friends alike. This makes him both a tragically heroic and a kind of bumbling figure. No Palestinian today is going to disavow Arafat and his leadership for the simple reason that despite all of his mistakes, he is being punished and humiliated because he is a Palestinian leader, and in that capacity, his mere existence offends people like Sharon and his American backers. I think Arafat's situation is largely a result of the occupation, and his mistakes have come from the occupation. But I think one has to look at the Sharonian view of the world, which has no place in it at all for Palestinians or for Arafat, whom he has been calling all sorts of terrible names for the past several years. Partly, I think, because Sharon has no ideas as such, and partly because of his immense bulk, he finds it therefore natural to do what he has always done, kill Palestinians, either by the bullet or by stifling them, the way a large pachyderm does to nasty little animals that happen to be there. Sharon has always held, this is very important, I think, also to understand, that Sharon has always held the notion that by dispensing with Arafat, he can then make a series of independent agreements with local warlords, rather the way the British in 19th century Africa...
Time. You've been listening to Professor Edward Said of Columbia University giving a speech on the Middle East conflict. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Lizzie Ratner, Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. We're still looking for end-of-the-year holiday gifts. You can give your money to a nonprofit as opposed to the Pentagon. Go to democracynow.org. We are broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.